In today's episode...
You know, and it's interesting, even though it's a lot of Gen Z and millennial workers that are driving this change, we now see it at, you know, every age. I was interviewing for an exec hire a few months back, and I talked to a number of candidates that had really short stints, and they're like, yeah, it wasn't really a good cultural fit. You know, our values didn't align. And I was like, yep, got it. Great. And that, you know, is just it's a different kind of set of rules than people were playing by pre-pandemic.
This week's episode is sponsored by AppSumo, the marketplace entrepreneurs trust to buy and sell products that grow small businesses into name brands. There's no better place for tools to help you build and grow your business. Whether you're a content creator, designer, or marketer, they're connected to some of the hottest tech companies, so you don't have to waste time searching for great stuff. AppSumo makes it easy for you to automate and boost your productivity so you can actually focus on your business. Sign up at AppSumo.com or hit the link in the description below. Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi, and I have a special guest today, Catherine Minshew. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, likewise. So I'm going to let you introduce yourself in a second, but you're the founder and CEO of The Muse. You've been on the block for a while now. I've heard of your name and your company for a while, been doing the rounds. Could you tell us a little bit about what you do, your background, and what The Muse is?
Yeah. As you said, I've been running The Muse for about a decade, which is wild in startup world. I feel like that makes me a bit ancient. The Muse is values aligned job search. And, I started the business really because I needed it and it didn't exist. And I'll say, actually, it took us 5 years to raise our first kind of serious venture funding. So that's a whole wild story in and of itself, but we've only been kind of a proper larger funded company for the last couple of years. But my background kind of in a nutshell is I moved with my family from kind of Dallas, Texas to Washington, D.C. when I was about 12. And very quickly around that time, I decided like I'm going to become a, you know, ambassador, a foreign service officer, or a CIA agent. I thought age 13, I had my career like all figured out. And obviously, as probably everyone listening to this podcast knows, the things you think that jobs are like as a child often bear very little resemblance to the actual careers. So I spent, you know, years majoring in political science, learning multiple languages, French, Turkish, et cetera, traveling all over with this dream in mind. And luckily in 2007, I had the chance to work for a U.S. embassy in Nicosia, Cyprus. And I realized like this career is not actually right for me at all. And I moved back to the U.S., worked for McKinsey for a couple of years, did a stint running a vaccine introduction in Rwanda with the Clinton Health Access Initiative funded by the Gates Foundation, like a couple of these different, very eclectic career experiences. But the entire time I was trying to figure out what is a job that I love enough that I could imagine doing it for a decade, much less the rest of my life. And I really became fascinated by how hard it is to navigate your career. A lot of the tools and job search sites online at the time were incredibly transactional. They were like, oh, you need a job? What job title do you want? What salary? Great. Here's 5,732 options. And it felt to me like title and salary were only one piece of the puzzle. And what was actually really interesting is, you know, what does the team and company feel like? What communication style is preferred? What is the office environment? And, you know, at that time, most people were in offices, but what does it look like? What does it feel like? How do people treat each other? What benefits are offered? Like all of this interesting contextual information that that really leads to people being either happy and motivated and productive or frustrated and unfulfilled in a job. And none of that was available. You could kind of condense it into this idea of fit or alignment. You know, do you feel like you're in the right place in this organization? And so the idea for The Muse really came out of my own experiences. That said, you know, I was roughly 25 when I started the business. There's a lot about startups that I did not know. And so, you know, our first version of the site was really simple. We were posting job descriptions with more detailed information about company culture and values. We had career advice and resources. Even though the business model was not necessarily particularly sophisticated, I think we really tapped into something that people were looking for. because, you know, very quickly, first 3 months of the site, we had, without any marketing budget or spend, 20,000, 26,000, and then 65,000 people who use the site each month. Now, as you said, you know, we have over 70 million people who use the Muse annually. So it's really been it's been a wild ride.
That's incredible. And so just to paint a picture, 70 million, that's a huge, huge number. So are there any other kind of things you could share on a sense of scale? I know you can't always share exact revenue numbers and stuff like that, but even a kind of a range or something that people could get a sense of how big you guys are?
Yeah. So the full-time team is about 65 people. We do, I guess I'll say, low double-digit millions in revenue. And, you know, we have about 10% of the Fortune 500 as current customers, as well as, you know, hundreds of other businesses across almost every industry, almost every size and shape, small companies, big companies. So I don't know if that helps give your listeners a sense, but
yeah, definitely.
You know, I sort of joke that we're a tweener in the startup world. We're much bigger than, you know, a lot of kind of nascent startups, which obviously we were for a very long time, but we're still so much smaller than a lot of the companies that we compete against, Indeed, Glassdoor, et cetera. You know, it's a fascinating time to be in this industry. So yeah, we're just trying to, you know, really punch above our weight and keep growing.
Awesome. And just on the, just so people are super clear, like, what is the business model? I know you mentioned Indeed and Glassdoor, and I think a lot of people have used those sites, but don't always understand, and your own, of course, but don't always understand like the economics of how things work, like who is paying who, because there's obviously a two-sided, you know, I don't know if you call it even a marketplace or not, but you've got the people posting jobs or the companies, you've got the content which you guys are creating, and then also the users or the people who are looking for jobs. So I'm assuming it's similar. My assumption is the money comes from the company side. They're paying to advertise on the site or post job listings. Is that as simple as it gets, or am I missing a huge piece there?
Yeah, no, I would say you're directionally right. In almost any business in the job search and career space, most of the revenue comes from the employers. And part of that is practical, and part of it is philosophical. You know, I knew when I started the Muse that I didn't want to create a product that was only available to people who had the money, particularly in the job search. That's often one of the times when people are the most financially insecure. At the same time, creating a business model that monetizes the employers can be really complicated. And one of the things that's so interesting is the business models in our space have changed pretty dramatically over time. And I'll just give you this very quick history, because I actually think it's instructive to what's happening more broadly and to some of the benefits and challenges we've had as a business. So many people listening probably remember, like, if you go back, you know, 10 or so years, the dominant model for job search sites was pay per posting. It was like, hey, you've got a job, I have an audience, give me, you know, $200 or $300 for 30 days. And like, whatever happens, happens. That was sort of based on the newspaper classifieds model. That was V1. Obviously, it had a lot of challenges. And so Indeed came along with a pay-per-click business model, which really revolutionized the industry. And they said, you only have to pay per click. It tied results, you know, to spend, which technically was kind of great initially. The problem was it led to the dominance for years of these business models based on high volume, low quality. Like, if you're charging per click or per applicant, it is in your business's best interest to drive as many clicks or as many applicants, which actually often creates a worse experience for a job seeker who's one of hundreds or thousands of applicants, and for businesses that are then sifting through a lot of really low quality options. And so when I started the Muse, I wanted to get to this idea of the right fit. And I really believed that if businesses invested upfront in communicating their culture, their value, their sort of employee experience, that would lead to higher quality hires that were better retained. And so I said, well, we should do an annual subscription model, because we're asking people to invest upfront. It's not transactional. It's not cost per click. And so we essentially have employers sign up for 12 to 24 month recurring subscriptions that give them access to the Muse's audience and job seekers, as well as a variety of, you know, feature functionality, upgrades to their job listings and profiles, data and analytics about their hiring process. this has been really interesting because, you know, even though we don't charge per click or per applicant, when I first was scaling the business, we would have customers come to us and they were like, well, I divided my annual subscription cost with you by the number of applicants you sent me, you know, over the last X months. And that works out to, you know, a Y cost per applicant, which is more expensive than Indeed. Therefore, I'm unhappy. And so we had to invest a huge amount of time and resources into actually saying, well, how many hires are you getting from that pool of applicants? Because it turns out that a Muse applicant is three times as likely to be hired as an applicant from Indeed. So we actually had a period early on where I thought the Muse might not survive because we had customers churning based on this kind of false metric of applicant cost. When we finally got them to look at per hire cost, which sounds like it should have been standard, but unfortunately wasn't 3 or 4 years ago at a lot of companies, we realized we were actually delivering a lot of value. And then going forward, now people, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of business owners are starting to look at the retention of the people they hire, not just, you know, overall retention, which is important, but, you know, if you bring someone in, you spend a lot of time and money recruiting them, do they last at least 6 months, 12 months? And it turns out we're really good at that as well. So the kind of long-term contracts, I think, will be ultimately really beneficial. But I will say it's in some ways been, you know, challenging to kind of get our buyers to accept a different way of paying for something that, you know, that they were used to doing.
No, that's really, really helpful context, actually. I didn't know that. And I've always been fascinated by this part of the business just because I know it's a, you know, in a good market or in a bad market, there's always needs. I mean, whatever you're, if you're Indeed or you guys or LinkedIn or anyone else offering jobs, like we're going into recession slash could already be in one right now. And there's going to be a huge need for, you know, these services to potentially change the way people are being hired as well, because I'm sure the priorities shift in a down market versus when everything's going up and all the companies are hiring and everyone's raising money easily, then it's just growth mode and everyone's happy to do whatever. And it also kind of reminded me a little bit, my background is in digital marketing. I worked at Google for a long time. So you mentioned pay-per-click. Google essentially kind of invented that in many ways in the digital marketing side anyway. And that was the way you described it there, felt like a marketing funnel, right, for a customer, right? Like any SaaS business or anyone else, that is you paid X amount to get that person. What was the lifetime value? What was the churn rate, et cetera? And
exactly.
But for companies, hiring is the most important thing, right? It's arguably the most important thing.
You know, it is, right? And I think you've probably had no shortage of people on the show being like, you know, our people are the reason we succeed or fail.
Yeah.
And yet, if you actually look at most companies, the way they spend on talent and HR, you know, acquiring, kind of recruiting people and retaining them is miles behind marketing. And that's something that has been, frankly, it's been one of my biggest frustrations as a founder, but it's also been the driver of some of my kind of deepest passions and commitment, because I actually think a lot of things that are wrong with employment today can be traced back to this short-termism and this transactional, and frankly, I would say fairly unsophisticated. Like, I love how you mentioned in marketing, we're not just saying, oh, we got to buy someone to come look at my website, or even, you know, driving someone to purchase your product is obviously important. But sophisticated marketers these days are looking at what's the average order volume or cart size. Does this person become a repeat customer? Like, they're looking at all of these other metrics that indicate not just have you, you know, to use like really crude terms, like have you kind of tricked someone or convinced them to just try you, but were they actually a good customer, and did you retain them, and kind of what was their LTV over time?
Yeah.
And I find it really fascinating that, you know, HR and talent acquisition has often been treated more as a back office than as a strategic function. A lot of our partners don't have access to particularly great data or tools. I mean, we had to do the early calculations for some of them around what are the applicant to hire ratios from different sources, and, you know, how do we think about the quality of a hire as opposed to just, you know, the kind of how fast, how cheap do I get a butt in the seat? And by the way, it's personal to me for a lot of reasons. It's obviously the kind of key thesis on which my entire business depends. But I've also seen it with, you know, in a sort of more simple sense, we went through a period of massive scale at the Muse when we raised our first venture round. And at the peak of that hiring, we had three recruiters. And one recruiter was pretty slow, but in retrospect was responsible for a large number of our best hires. One recruiter was sort of like the Goldilocks middle, and one recruiter was really fast and responsible for the vast majority of our mishires and the people we got wrong. And so, you know, when you set up hiring systems to prioritize how fast and how cheap can I fill this role, you end up encouraging people to be inauthentic, to say what it takes to get someone close, and to prioritize tools and, you know, partners and marketplaces that get you the cheapest hire, but maybe not necessarily the best, especially if you're not even measuring to understand quality. And so I think that, that the idea of talent is going through a massive change. And I really hope that we come out of it with a much more thoughtful and long-term understanding of what, you know, a good hire looks like. And it's going to change the spend. It's going to change the tools that are successful, which obviously I think is a huge opportunity.
Yeah, 100%. We're going to talk a little bit about like how things have changed since the last couple of years, the Great Resignation, etc. And as I mentioned earlier, the recession we're kind of going into right now, and how that might change things for employees and employers. But just to close out that part on the business model, to give specifics, if you're able to share, again, even if this is a range, but like how much does it typically cost a company to work with your company? And the second part to that question is, on average in the industry, is there like an average of how much it costs to normally hire one person? Because it's normally very, very high, more than most people would actually think, because people don't realize like the amount of money that goes into screening that person, the staff that are in recruiting, and then all the interviews that you have to do, training those people up, etc. So yeah, I don't know if you know that second part, but maybe we start with the first one, which was how much you charge those companies.
Yeah, I'll give you a little bit of a sense of both. So for the Muse, we have a kind of huge range of prices based on how large a company is, how many roles it's hiring for, and how much, you know, they want to sort of stand out and, you know, kind of gather a lot of mind share and engagement on the site versus dip their toe in the water. We have, you know, small businesses and startups that pay $5,000 to $6,000 a year, which is a couple hundred bucks a month. And then we have, you know, massive global brands that are paying kind of low six figures. So every, you know, we have kind of standard pricing, but then a lot of customers, especially bigger ones, will say, well, you know, what can I put on top of that? And so kind of 70% of our business is really high margin recurring subscription products. And then on top of that, we have these sort of promotional tools and different things. You know, you can think of it like a company that wants to include a profile of one of their successful engineers in an email blast going out to all the engineers on the Muses platform, something like that.
Got it.
So that's kind of how our business model works. You know, in terms of cost per hire, one of the reasons that's tricky to answer is companies are willing to pay a lot more for, you know, a mid-level data science manager than they are an entry-level customer service associate. Companies are also starting to be willing to pay a lot more for diverse candidates. And so, you know, when I mentioned kind of our business model and advantages before, one of the other things we're really good at is of the people, you know, the 70 million people annually who are using the Muse, 63% are female. LinkedIn is 43% female. So we are much kind of better on that gender diversity. We actually skew more women. And our community is about 58% people of color. So it's very, very diverse community, which also kind of factors.
You say 58%?
58%.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Is that just within the US or that's a global number?
That is our global number, but yeah, the vast majority of our users are US based. And
people,
by the way, are surprised by that. And, and I'll say, first of all, so we've measured these statistics every year, and that number has marched up by a few percentage points every single year. So in 2020, we were 54% people of color. And I believe it was 49 or 50% in 2019, which is the first year we started doing this kind of macro survey with the same methodology. And when people ask, why is that the case? There's a number of different factors, but frankly, one of the biggest is, you know, we're the only job search site where someone can say, I'd like to work at a company that offers paternity leave, tuition reimbursement, adoption assistance, fertility benefits. I want to look at a company's DE&I commitments. I want to understand more about a company's culture and values in a deeper level. And so I think both because we offer a lot of search criteria and kind of company research that is hard to get in other places, and that's probably even more relevant to, you know, somebody from a diverse background. And also, you know, when I started the Muse, I had a lot of experiences where I was one of the only women in the room. And I, you know, felt like very, very personally how hard it can be to be the only, and also to have people, even well-meaning people, ascribe all sorts of impressions and stereotypes to who they think you are just based on what you look like. And so it was just really important to me from, you know, day zero of the Muse that we architect the entire site and experience in a way that was incredibly kind of cognizant of the diversity of people and perspectives that exist in the workforce. And so, you know, we've heard that a lot of our users have learned about the Muse through word of mouth or kind of small, you know, offline and some online, but social networks. And I think a lot of people feel like we are so different from other products in the space that we kind of really punch outside our weight with people that care about, you know, a more inclusive and diverse future of work. And that, by the way, that includes everyone. That includes, you know, lots of straight white guys that are like, hey, I want to work for a company that values diversity as well. I care about these things. I love that. I want the Muse to be kind of applicable to a really broad set of people. But I do think that idea of inclusion is at the core of everything we do. And, you know, sometimes it's definitely made life harder for us, but I think it's just, first of all, it's the right thing to do. I think it's where the future is going. And I think we see that in then the people who end up using and, you know, sharing about the site and you know, evangelizing us to others.
That's awesome. Yeah. I'd love to come onto that in a little bit more detail in the second half of the show around how companies can attract talent, but also do it in an authentic way and maybe paint a couple of contrasting examples together. But that was really helpful context. One question that popped up while you were saying that stuff, I just had this random thought about a company called Palette. I don't know if you've come across them, but for people who don't know, this is my impression from the outside. I don't actually know the details, but because I've had a lot of creators on the show, even myself, and I have a second podcast with a guy called Jack and Trung, two guys, and I think Jack uses them as well. I've seen this trend where a lot of creators who have their own audience within, let's say, a certain sub-vertical. So Lenny, who's all about product managers, and he's, you know, has a huge community around that. And then, you know, there's a Pomp who has the whole crypto thing. So there's plenty of people who kind of built up this audience to a certain size. And then one of the ways they're able to kind of create their own micro, you know, job site essentially is by using this company called Palette. I'm curious if you've got any thoughts on that approach for, you know, I guess one from the creator's point of view, but also a job seeker, because there's like the horizontal approach, which is go on to the Muse, go on to LinkedIn, Indeed, etc., where you're going to see the most jobs. But then this kind of more vertical, narrow approach. Do you feel like there's space for both of those in the long run, or do you think it's more like a trend that's just happening right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think from everything I've heard of Palette, and I've been following them for a bit, I think the idea is super interesting. And I do think the future involves both, right? You know, when you look at almost anything with consumer preference, you have a mix of sites that cater to kind of a broad array of options, give you a lot of choice, a lot of visibility. Sometimes those sites can actually have deeper information on each option, be it, you know, kind of ratings, reviews, content, et cetera, because they're large. And then you also have kind of more specialized, either community-driven or niche-driven options for people who have a very particular interest. And, you know, they want to kind of go and be surrounded by other people who share that particular interest. So I think the idea that they're going after is a super interesting one. It's funny, actually, because it's something that we've discussed before I'd actually even heard of them. We discussed it internally at the Muse, you know, how might we partner with smaller communities and potentially, you know, for an individual creator or the owner of a, you know, a small group, it can actually be really deceptively hard to monetize with, you know, job search and recruiting. A lot of people want to reach your audience, but actually building out the infrastructure to sell into businesses, manage contracts, make sure people are happy, like, it's really challenging. And so I do think we'll see both, you know, Palette, and we're definitely talking about some interesting options, you know, this sort of move into more micro-based recruiting communities in some areas. And again, I think it's really interesting. And, you know, the whole world is kind of becoming more personalized. It's part of my pitch to investors who are like, well, you know, how are you going to take on Indeed? Like, part of why people use the Muse today is that ability to indicate, this is what I care about, and I want to find something that is more aligned. And I think that some of these, you know, kind of sites that help create creators and smaller groups, you know, monetize via recruiting are on that same trend. I think it's super smart. And, you know, the recruiting is a massive space. It's $124 billion market in just the United States alone. And by the way, online dating is a $2 billion.
That's so wild. You know, sorry, just to say that again, 124 versus two.
$124 billion. And the thing is, right, every single business hires employees. Every single nonprofit hires employees. And not only employees, but when you think about most businesses, they have their executive recruiting, their senior level recruiting, mid-level, individual contributor, hourly. You know, there are so many different needs. There's so much money spent. I realize I didn't fully answer your question before about kind of cost per hire. Again, there's huge variety. The average that is, I believe, stated by SHRM, which is the Society of Human Resource Management, is, I believe, around $5,000. I don't have the exact stat in front of me. I want to say like 5,200.
That's the number I had in my head as well. So yeah, I think we probably read the same thing at some point.
$5,000. And again, you know, for less experienced roles where a company is hiring, you know, in bulk, quote unquote, they might be spending $700 per hire, $1,100 per hire. If they're doing a lot of them and the vetting is, you know, less intensive. For mid-level roles, you know, some of the roles that get hired on the Muse's site, let's say someone's looking for a data scientist or, you know, a really experienced seller, it is not uncommon for companies to budget $20,000 to $25,000 each hire for those roles. And then obviously executive recruiting is $100,000 or more. We don't typically deal in that because the sort of human to human work that's required at the exec recruiting front, I don't think lends itself to, you know, scalable software for us, at least as well. We are very, very good at kind of individual contributor, manager, and like director level hiring in, you know, sales, marketing, engineering, design, product, data, finance ops, like core functions of, you know, frankly, most companies. But yeah, when you think about that, just that average, you know, roughly $5,000 per hire is staggering, the amount of money that gets spent. And I would say, you know, back to our conversation from the beginning, a lot of it today is getting spent very badly. We looked at some of our customers' applicant tracking system data, and for a lot of these more professional roles, you know, again, entry, mid-level, full-time salaried roles, we had a lot of companies that were seeing 600 applications from Indeed per hire that they were making. That is a huge amount of time and effort just going to weed through candidates that are mostly not incredibly qualified. And I think that is a direct result of these old school business models that have been like cost per click, just, you know, get people to apply. Some of these sites have auto apply functions where you can just say, yeah, here's my resume, auto apply me for any job that meets these criteria. If you're looking for a call center job and you're desperate for work, that might make sense. But if you are, you know, a kind of typical salaried professional today, that doesn't result in the best experience, and it tends to not result in the best retained and most productive employees either, which is what, you know, the data is starting to show.
This episode is sponsored by The Economist. If you're listening to this right now, I know you like to stay on top of things. The world is moving at a faster pace than ever. Climate and economics, politics and culture, science and technology. Wherever you look, events are unfolding at pace. And now for the first time, you can get a 30-day trial of The Economist so you won't miss a thing. I've read The Economist since I studied economics at university. It's my go-to source for deeply researched expert analysis, and it allows me to hone in on what matters most to me. With this trial, you'll get access
to in-depth, independent coverage of world events through their podcasts, webinars, expert analysis, and even their extensive archives. So whether you want to catch up with current events or deep dive into specific issues, The Economist delivers global perspectives with distinctive clarity. For example, I just read through the recent analysis of what happened with Boris Johnson stepping down as Prime Minister. So get access to that and a 30-day trial by going to economist.com/lab for full access to topics that matter to you. That is economist.com/lab to start your 30-day trial with The Economist today, because the world won't wait. That's awesome. That's very helpful context. And the reason I asked that question was for people who listen to this who are interested in starting companies. One of the things I always look for is just where the money is, right? And the opportunity here is the difference between selling, you know, again, like $100 pair of shoes to an individual. Like to acquire that user often costs within a similar range to acquiring a company who spends $5,000, $10,000. I know it's a very different kind of sale, obviously, and there's a sales team, there's an account management team, and there's other parts to it in a business like this. But I think a lot of people, if you look at like high level industries that haven't been disrupted as much or are still being disrupted, like because they're often not as sexy, so to speak, right? Like they're not consumer driven, they're not this fancy new tech trend or VR and AR and all this, you know, fancy stuff. Whereas, you know, like, you know, there's been plenty of companies been working in this space for many years trying to create, you know, alternatives, you guys being one of them. So anyway, that's very helpful knowledge, very helpful context, sorry. And let's go into a little bit about painting a picture where we are today, because, you know, we're recording this the summer of 2022. We've all been through a couple years of craziness, and there have been, I actually did an episode just before the pandemic, I think November 2019, with a guy called Hiten Shah, and he did this whole report on remote work, and we talked about remote work being the future. And even in 2019, just a few months before it all changed, I was a bit of a skeptic still. I was like, oh, okay, I get it, but there's so many things that need to be done in person, et cetera, et cetera. But 6 months later, we were all doing it. So I'm curious from your vantage point, I know you do lots of surveys and you're working with companies in the space. So where do you think we're netting out now as people are starting to go back to the office? And what are some of the things that are still going to be here from the pandemic?
Yeah, you know, it is, like you said, we've all gone through this massive forced social experiment. I don't think anybody expected the kind of intensity of the shift to remote work and how long it's lasted. And so, you know, I think we're still collectively redesigning our vision for what good work and good teamwork looks like in the years to come. And so there's so many different, you know, experiments going on right now. They're obviously not intended necessarily. Companies are trying different things. They're, you know, they're succeeding, they're failing, et cetera. Some of the big trends I'm seeing. So one is that most companies are convening or sort of, or looking at hybrid models, but instead of the kind of, you know, I would say a year ago, people were talking about hybrid being 2 to 3 days a week. We're now actually seeing a lot of companies that the Muse works with looking at, you know, a few days a month, or kind of convening teams around specific strategic planning, brainstorming, the types of activities that often do really benefit from being, you know, co-located in the same space. Exactly. Yeah. But then, you know, maybe it's the other 3.5 weeks of the month, or, you know, the other kind of 2.75, you know, months of the quarter, people are doing their work in whatever geographic location they choose to. I've also seen a few companies that do 2 to 3 days a week most of the year, but then have picked 2 months, you know, let's say a winter month and a summer month, where everyone's remote, to give people that maximum flexibility. And I think it's this kind of continued intersection of work and life that, you know, that frankly, talent is demanding. With, you know, we've talked a lot about the fact that we could be facing a recession. Every time the job market shifts away from what workers want, there is this counter, you know, this sort of counter voice of employers saying, ha ha, you know, we're back on top now. Workers are going to have to do what we want them to do. But guess what? It's really short-lived. It has been short-lived in 2008. It was short-lived in 2020. It will be short-lived now. And what's so fascinating to me is that the businesses that take that approach of trying to sort of force their will on their employees because their employees are temporarily weakened enough by the economy to put up with it. Those are often the businesses that suffer the greatest turnover when the economy comes back because people remember. And so, you know, while I do think that a lot of businesses are gonna, you know, bring their people back together for the type of team building, ideation, brainstorming that, you know, that does work best in person, I think that businesses that do it really thoughtfully and say, when should we be back together? And let's support that. When could we be flexible or remote? And let's allow that, are probably going to be more successful than businesses that are, you know, a bit arbitrary. And it's been really interesting. You know, you mentioned data. We do a lot of surveying right now in the workforce. And a couple data points that are fascinating. One is, you know, we did a new grad survey looking at a lot of Gen Z talent that is entering the workforce right now. And 75% said that they would not come into the office 5 days a week, even with a salary increase above market rate. And about half of all respondents said they would need 20% or more above market value to come in 5 days a week. So I think businesses are going to find that if they're not really prestigious or really highly compensating, they're going to have to embed flexibility in what they do to get, again, this is top talent. I think businesses that have decided they don't need to compete for the best people and they can take people that are perhaps a little bit more desperate, they will have more flexibility to force what they want onto their workers, but that will likely lead to, you know, some reduction in the type of talent that they can hire. So, you know, it's really been interesting. There's also just in every age demographic, there's kind of stronger and stronger desire for more work-life balance. That has something that has, I think, come out of the, you know, life is short experience of the pandemic. And then younger generations are really prioritizing learning and growth. Older generations are sometimes more, you know, focused on the benefits, the compensation, the kind of company support for other elements of their life.
Got it. No, that has stuck with me. That might be the snippet for the show. Because, that is something I've felt, obviously, even myself. So I've worked in the office for a long time. And Google culture was pretty good. And you could be flexible as you needed to back in the day. But you couldn't just go and work for 3 weeks in Mexico City, right? Like, so I had left the workforce a few years ago, like 3-4 years ago now, to start my own stuff. And now I kind of work from wherever, kind of before the pandemic. But now seeing like friends have the balance of like a lot of my friends still at Google, and they have, I think, a rule of Tuesday to Thursday, they have to be in the office right now. Monday and Friday, they're off, which was kind of that second segment you kind of mentioned. And I think for them, that works pretty well. Like, especially a lot of them are in sales and they kind of need to meet customers, do stuff in person. So it what makes sense. For a lot of the engineers, though, a lot of engineers are like, why am I having to come in to the office when I can do this from home without distractions a lot of the time? Well, it depends. If you've got kids, might be a different story. But
I think you're completely right, though. I think that one of the things that is going to happen as we get more sophisticated about remote, hybrid, in-office work is that businesses are going to say, we actually shouldn't be treating all of our teams the same. And, you know, there are teams that are going to benefit more from in-person than others. And so I think that's going to be another big trend. We're just starting to see it. But because, you know, as the shift to remote work was so dramatic, and now companies are really, we're in kind of phase one of figuring out the post-COVID way of working. So people obviously, they always start with a little bit more like blunt force instrument. Okay, everyone in, you know, 3 days a week. And over time, I think we're going to see more nuance and more variability, especially by function and by team, as you said, not just, you know, which functions and teams are most competitive to keep and, you know, attract talent, but also how does work truly need to get done? And I think it's going to be hard if employees are mostly doing solo work. And let's say they're, you know, sitting in conference rooms at the office on Zoom calls, convincing them that they have to be there instead of at home is going to be really tricky versus people that come in and, you know, they sit around a whiteboard, they're, you know, brainstorming, customer meeting, et cetera. Those are things that that do really benefit from that face-to-face.
Yeah, 100%. I've also heard you talk about this phrase shift shock. So could you explain what that is before and like what is that problem right now for people?
Yeah. So I named the term shift shock a couple months ago, earlier this year, to refer to that feeling that I think most of us have experienced, where you start a new job and realize with surprise or regret that it is not what you were led to believe, or it's not as advertised. And I was particularly interested in this phenomenon in shift shock because, you know, it's as old as recruiting, right? You've always had situations where someone accepts a job believing it's going to be one thing and shows up at the you know, workplace or virtual or physical and realizes it's something else. But what's different about this kind of post-COVID shift shock is employees are actually quitting. So previously, and I don't know if this was the case for you, but I imagine, you know, when I started work 14 years ago, when I started work, it was kind of pretty clearly communicated to me that if I left my job in under 2 years, that was a black mark on my resume that I might never recover from.
And people would always ask you, was this gap or like there's lack of confidence in like you couldn't handle it or something went wrong, basically, right?
Exactly. Immediately was assumed that you were the problem. Now we've seen this massive societal shift where when we surveyed workers under 40 on the Muse, 80% of them said it was perfectly acceptable to leave a new job in under 6 months if it wasn't as advertised. And this is, I mean, I don't think I can underestimate what a seismic shock this is for some employers. I say some because employers that have always practiced a more authentic and transparent recruiting are not seeing the impacts of this so dramatically because most of the people that they recruit show up at the business and find it's more or less what they thought it was going to be, and they stay. Employees don't want to quit a job that they just started, but they will if that job is not what they were promised, especially if that's in material ways. And so I think the prohibition that society used to have against leaving a job after starting actually enabled a lot of really bad behavior in recruiting. Because going back to what we were talking about at the top of the episode, you know, it allowed recruiters and businesses in some cases to, you know, to lie or to sugarcoat or to hide things about a job because you just got to get somebody in the door. And, you know, I'm gold based on how fast I close this role. Closing a role, if somebody quits 3 months later, is actually worse for the company than if it was open for longer. And so, you know, we've seen that in our data, I think it was about 41% of people would give a new job or company 2 to 6 months. 20% of people would leave in under a month if it wasn't as advertised. And again, roughly 80% of people said it was acceptable to do this. And so this is just, it's totally changing the way that employers have to think about recruiting. I think it's going to create more incentives for good behavior and punishments for bad behavior, which always a good thing. You know, and it's interesting, even though it's a lot of Gen Z and millennial workers that are driving this change, we now see it at, you know, every age. I was interviewing for an exec hire a few months back, and I talked to a number of candidates that had really short stints, and they're like, yeah, it wasn't really a good cultural fit. You know, our values didn't align. And I was like, yep, got it. Great. Yeah. And that, you know, is just it's a different kind of set of rules than people were playing by pre-pandemic.
That's awesome. And just to close things out, I did have a couple of questions on, you've obviously helped lots and lots of people find work and obviously on the company side, attracting people to work there. But just on a personal level, and this might be even from your own experience or friends and people that you've helped, a lot of people go through this shift where they've started a job, like you had mentioned in the past, and it isn't exactly what you said or what you expected. I think personally, a lot of that is also like we're both millennials, I think, and we basically have gone through this thing where I think Gen Z as well are going through it, where your expectation didn't meet reality, which wasn't just because the place was bad. It was also because our expectations might have been too high, or, you know, so there's two sides to it for sure. But what happens to that person when they're trying to figure out what the next step is? Is there like a way you think about it, even for yourself? Or is this, I'm sure you guys have done research on this as well, to help people? Because I think a lot of people go through this, including myself. So curious if you've got any advice there.
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the most important elements in any career search is, what do you actually care the most about? And that sometimes gets overlooked, right? Because we talk about, oh, you know, you need a higher salary. You should get a better title. Should you work for this really prestigious company? Cool. Those things can all matter a lot to you. Great if they do. But I think it's actually really helpful before you leave your current job, or if you're unemployed, before you kind of throw your hat in 50 rings, to really try and get clear what matters the most to me. Because if you can identify your priorities, you're much more likely to be able to find a role at a business that's aligned. For people that have started a new job and they're not happy, I think that it's also helpful to understand, is this a kind of toxic or abusive workplace, or is it a workplace that's just not aligned with how I want to work and what matters to me?
Yeah.
And that, first of all, is really helpful learning. You know, a workplace where people throw staplers across the room at each other's heads, probably somewhere that you should consider getting out of. But if there's a workplace that, for example, one of my early jobs was hyper direct, hyper aggressive, no emojis, no exclamation points, don't even ask about people's weekends, get to the data, get the work done.
Was this McKinsey by any chance?
I will neither confirm nor deny where it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was an environment that worked really well for some people. And just because it might not have been the most energizing environment for me doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad place to work. In fact, I know people who actually loved that environment because it fit how they wanted to work. It taught me a really important lesson about what I did and didn't want in my next role that I was then able to take into further interviews. And so, I think it's easy to think about kind of top line things like how much does, compensation, title, prestige matter? And again, those are useful questions to ask, but there's also just this much kind of deeper list of elements. We actually, my co-founder and I wrote a book and we put a whole grid in there at the beginning called the Muse Method, where we talked about things like, flexibility, creativity, how much, consistency versus change do you want in your job? And I think the more you articulate what matters, the more likely you are to go and get it. And then I would say, when you are interviewing, come up with some of the questions ahead of time that will help you zero in on the specific attributes that you care about. So you might ask somebody, who's part of the team that you're thinking of joining. Hey, I was wondering, in your last product launch, can you describe to me like how the kind of communication and planning was structured in the last 3 weeks? What sort of hours were people working? Can you give me an idea of, what happened when something went off track? Like, you can start to ask questions that give you deeper information. And if you are in the position to kind of get an offer and you feel comfortable enough, I'm also seeing a lot of candidates say, hey, I'm really excited to join the team. I want to make sure it's a great fit. Could I talk to one or two of my future colleagues to learn a bit more about their experience working here before I say yes? And again,
it's like the way you get a reference check on yourself. You kind of need to do it yourself as the employee too.
Absolutely. And by the way, I've done this for the last couple executives that I've hired at the Muse. I've said, hey, do you want to talk to obviously current, other folks on the exec team you're in touch with, but do you want to talk to execs who worked for me who aren't at the Muse any longer, but can give you a sense of what I'm like to work with? Because I want to make sure that somebody is opting in to the situation as it is. Every single company has a different personality or culture. And if you give people that insight up front, they're more likely to be productive, to be successful, and to be, to be retained, which is, I think, what we all want at the end for both sides of that match.
Yeah, 100%. No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, like there's no point tricking someone to come there and now you're locked in. It's like they're not going to be happy anyway. So it's better just to be up front and make sure people get that figured out. So last question, because I know we're going to wrap up shortly. And thanks for all this. This has been very, very helpful insight. I think a hot topic nowadays in the workplace has become this dichotomy of what is acceptable at work in terms of, whether it's sharing compensation transparently across the org. Like I remember one time at Google, a rogue engineer basically released a Google Doc and a form that anyone could, put in their salary, their level, job title, etc. And like just shared it with everyone. And there was a lot of chaos because of that. That was one example. But in more recent times, I'd say since the pandemic anyway, there's been, a lot of activism has become, you know, a lot of a bigger priority for younger people since forever, but especially in the last few years. And I'd say in the workplace, it's become more of a discussion point anyway. So I'm looking at an example like Coinbase. Brian Armstrong, the founder and CEO there, publicly kind of wrote this letter to the, well, he shared it internally first and then published it externally. And my summary of that letter was essentially, when you come to work, we're here for this mission. Don't talk about these other things, because it was getting out of control in his point of view. And when I talk about that, I'm sure it means like lots of different issues going on. But yeah, so people in Slack, people in email message boards, etc., discussing stuff. And in his opinion, were getting distracted, I guess, from their core mission. And that was quite a big moment, especially in the tech industry, to say that's the first time someone who's that prominent has kind of come out and said something like that. And I think since then, there's been a couple of other prominent CEOs who've done something similar. And this is juxtaposed with, you know, my time, let's say, just anecdotally being at Google, and a lot of my friends work at Google and Facebook, a lot of those kind of big tech companies, where on both sides, in a, and I don't mean that politically, I mean on a good and bad side, there's the good side, which is, you know, people like me who are from different backgrounds feel more comfortable talking about certain things. But at the same time, on the negative side, some people might say, you know, get distracted, or people are afraid to say things what they really think. So I'm curious, from your point of view, seeing this, how should companies think about this kind of whole area, you know, if you want to call it activism within the workplace, or other people might say overlaps with politics? Like, what is the right way to do this, you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is a super nuanced topic, and obviously one that we won't be able to do justice to in the next just, you know, 2 minutes. But, you know, at a high level, I think that employee voices and some level of activism is here to stay in the workplace. You know, we have, I think, learned a lot of truths about the world, about America in the last few years, that it's hard to unsee. The experience of, you know, people from different backgrounds, different genders, different orientations, and how the world is sometimes, I think, you know, not fair and not unbiased. And so I think it is, you know, we see that, I think it was 60% of Gen Z employees would leave an employer over a clash of values. And something like 83% of Gen Z and millennials want brands that they support or work for to align with them on values. So this broad idea that people want to join organizations that kind of are making the world better versus worse, is, I don't think it's going away at all. And frankly, social media contributes to this to some extent, because we live our lives online visibly. We are attached to the companies that we work for. And so I think there's an element of, you know, I want to join companies that I'm proud to be associated with. And again, like, that's not going away. At the same point, is there, you know, are there people and organizations that have perhaps taken this too far? Yeah, totally. You know, anytime you have a big social change, there's a lot of like, everyone's figuring out what's the right new relationship here. And so, you know, I don't think everyone's gotten it right so far, and that's to be expected. I think that there is, you know, there are some conversations that businesses can't have. For example, we have some customers of the Muse that have politics or belief that don't align with mine personally. And when employees have raised that, I've said, look, the goal of the Muse is to help people find a place to work that aligns with their values and priorities. It's not to help them find a place to work that aligns with my values and priorities. As much as I would love for everyone to share my values and priorities, like, the world is a really diverse, complicated, different place. And it's okay to have people who disagree with us and to work closely with them. And at the same point, I think that, you know, we are seeing that women, people of color, you know, all sorts of different groups are saying, hey, I don't want to be treated like a second-class citizen. I want to have a conversation about what could make the workplace more fair, more equitable, more inclusive for people like these. And I don't love when you know, really powerful white guys totally shut down that conversation, even if that's obviously not the intent. I'm not speaking about a specific situation. So I think that we've got to find that kind of, you know, Goldilocks just right balance of allowing and accepting that these conversations about values, about identities, about positions, like they are happening. And I think businesses that try to restrict them too aggressively are going to end up driving away a lot of really great people, because that is just what we're seeing in the data. A lot of candidates are looking for. And you know, trying to make sure that your employees feel supported, that you're a great place to work for people of diverse backgrounds, doesn't mean that you have to get involved in every single political issue or every single conversation. But I do think that employees are looking for businesses to at least pick a few things that are, you know, sort of values aligned and take a stand on them. Because frankly, I think a lot of people also don't feel like they have as much political power. And so advocating for, you know, better policies at the places they work is one of the things they can do. And, you know, it was really interesting, like after the leak of the Supreme Court draft on Roe v. Wade, we had a lot of employers reaching out to us and a lot of candidates and saying, you know, candidates were saying, does my employer cover abortion for people who live out of state? What is my employer's perspective on this? A lot of employers were saying, well, you know, what is the Muse seeing in the candidate pool? And, you know, how should we think about reacting? Are there other companies that have rolled out policies that we should consider adopting? I think we are going to see kind of this trend continue of companies needing to be involved in some way, not in everything, not all the time, but in some things some of the time. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing for the world, but it is something that, you know, can't, like almost any good thing, take it to the extreme and you lose a lot of the value that you had to begin with.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I know we're just hitting time there, so I know we're going to have to cut off now. But thank you again for coming on the show. Where can people check you out? Is there anywhere people should follow on social media or check out, obviously, the Muse as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, definitely follow the Muse on Instagram, on Twitter. We're just at the Muse, T-H-E-M-U-S-E. People can also follow me personally. I'm at K-Min, K-M-I-N on Twitter, and at K-Minshu on Instagram. It's the bane of my existence that I can't get them both to match. Not really, but I know
the feeling. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Got the same thing.
Yeah, I would say those are the best. And then obviously, you know, I'd love for people to check out the Muse, themuse.com, you know, tweet me, at me, let me know what you think. And, you know, I still feel like we're only in the early innings. So I'm really excited to, you know, see what the next couple of years hold.
Awesome. Thanks so much for taking so much time today and for enlightening us on this space. And yeah, hopefully we'll get to do this in person next time as well. We're not too far from each other.
Absolutely. Well, I've loved it. I had a great time and thank you again for having me on.
Appreciate it. All right, have a good one. Cheers.
Cheers.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, BZAIDI, or creatorlabfm on any other channel. I really appreciate it. Helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.